Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield, and once again, we are journeying into the centre circle. And once again, we are joined by what is essentially my favourite author. And considering two of my co-hosts are also authors, that's quite a brave statement to make, especially as I spend a lot of time with them. But our special guest is actually my most favourite author that we have on. And judging by his talent, we've had him on quite a few times, which obviously goes to show he's also not only my favourite, but also a prolific author as well. But before we get to the special guest and the book, first of all, got to welcome my other two joint favourite authors, first of all, Mr. Gary Thacker. Gary, welcome.
Thanks, buddy. Yeah, and I'm happy to sort of confirm that our special guest today is also my favourite author as Brilliant. Well. So, yeah, you know, when I heard it got that... you got a book coming out. We just got to get him on because, as you say, everything this guy writes is—it's so readable. I mean, I think it's the best way to say. You know, sometimes you can get a book and you're thinking, oh, you know, I'm on page 12 and this feels like I've been going on an hour. But on this one, you think you're three quarters way through the book before you realise where you're going. And it's a great book. So great to have this guy on again. Bloody great writer.
Like we say, great and prolific. And the other co-host is Mr. Stephen Scragg. Now, I'm not sure if Stephen's actually with us.
Oh, I am.
There was his big smile on face.
I am. Oh. I'm having, I don't know what it is with the, we've kind of caught Hull's internet communism. So I've switched off my camera to give me, yeah, so I'm kind of like, I don't know, just like a crank handle on the side of my laptop or something like that going on. So I've muted my face just to see if it improves the signal.
Is that a new technical term to mute
your face? Yeah, it's a new terminology. And I'm sure Lewis is laughing, saying it will make no difference whatsoever. But in a daddy pig kind of way, I've gone for just muting my face.
Excellent. Well, apart
from muting my face, I would add to that that yes, Jeff is my favourite author as well. So you got the full hat trick tonight, Jeff.
Excellent.
No pressure. No.
Congratulations,
no pressure.
Jeff. Fully paid up founder members. Obviously tonight's guest and the book. The more things change, the more things stay the same. Almost 100 years ago, Liverpool were winning the third league title, going on to successfully retain it a year later and earning with it the nickname of the Untouchables. And now a new book is out by that very name, which vividly brings the past to life. It's co-authored by what is essentially all our favourite author, Mr. Jeff Goulding, alongside Kieran Smith. And it's a labour of love that illuminates as much as what binds the past to the present as it does separates them. So, Jeff, everybody's favourite author, welcome to the podcast.
Well, listen, guys, the check is in the post. thank you very much for that. I'm blushing. I'm very, very honoured because you're all my favourite authors.
Brilliant.
Absolutely delighted to be on. Thanks for having me on. I always have a great time on the podcast. And I'm really looking forward to talking about this book because it was a labour of love. And I really now feel like I know a generation of footballers better than I know the current crop, to be honest with you, because we've really delved into their lives and learned what made them tick, what their origin stories were. And, you know, so absolutely delighted to be able to talk about it tonight.
It's brilliant. I mean, like I say, we've all had the pleasure of the book early and reading it. And it's something that I'm going to ask Gary in a second about learning about. It's almost forced focus, forced attention to in this 24-hour saturation, Jeff. Like you say, you think you know all there is to know about the current crop of footballers, but actually, when you've researched a book like you have, and then when you put it on the page like you have, actually, you seem to learn a lot more about the people and the players than Sky Sports 24-hour news will ever be able to teach you about Trent Alexander-Arnold, for example.
Yeah, it's a strange one because on the face of it, you would think there's very little footage available of these guys in action. There is no footage with sound, so we don't get to hear their voices. We get hints of what they sounded like from quotes and from family members, but we don't get to hear them. And yet, it's been possible. You know, I mean, tremendous amount of work, and I've got to pay tribute to my co-author Kieran Smith, who's a fantastic historian, and the detective work that he's done to help uncover some of the finer details. It has been possible to really, I think, paint a three-dimensional image of these guys in a way that I didn't think was possible when we set out to do it.
I'll come to you in a second about the reasons behind this, but before I do that, Gary, I'm going to have to ask you the first question. So, a nice, easy one to start off with.
Here we go.
If you were delving back into pre YouTube and pre footage, is it something you would consider? And if it is, would you look to go to your own club, Chelsea, or would you look? I know you're obviously a big fan of European football and how football's developed in Europe, particularly in the Netherlands, but where would you go? Would you consider, and where would you go for a book like this?
I guess the short answer is I wouldn't have a clue where to start. I wouldn't. Your first sort of port of call would be Google and see where that leads you. I think it's interesting just to divert very quickly about the contrast what you said, Stu, between what Sky tells you about footballers and what this book tells you about footballers. This book makes Sky look a mile wide and an inch deep, whereas this sort of delves into proper depth and you learn more about these guys than many, as Jeff said, many current players. I don't know, it's difficult. I mean, when I did the beautiful bridesmaids about the part of Dutch football, it was a bit sketchy because it was only the preamble to the main story. But when you've got something like this, which is built around a story 100 and more than 100 years old, and the depth of research that's clearly got into this to find out intimate details of these guys is stunning. Jeff mentioned about his co-author Kieran being an historian. He must be a decent guy as well, decent historian as well, because the research, the dedication, I think, as well, to find the details that Jeff's got in the book is, as I say, it's stunning.
For you, Stephen, obviously you're a Liverpool fan, and obviously there's clearly a reason why you and Jeff got on so well. But in terms of Liverpool it is an incredible history that Liverpool Football Club has. But is this a story that needed telling?
Yes.
You have to say yes because Jeff's written a whole book on it. I formulated the question and thought, what a great question. Then when I heard it, I was like, oh my God, what if he says no? But yeah, I trust you to say yes.
It's a definite yes. It's a definite yes. I mean, for a club like Liverpool, and there's so many big clubs that win so much out there, and it's mad, like 19 league titles, and you think you know stuff, but then the stuff that you don't know. For Liverpool, there is a propensity to take them on from once Shankly joins in 59, and what comes before is underappreciated. It's like Liverpool. There's Liverpool BC, but it's before Shankly as such, and then after, there's a very much a dividing line there, and because everything about Liverpool prior to Shankly taking over was so grey, detached from what they would become. It's kind of understandable. Shankly took them over in the second division, so he took them from nothing to everything. But the fact that it goes forgotten that there was more to Liverpool. Liverpool were everything beforehand. Shankly takes over a team that's Yeah, they've never won the FA Cup. They've never ventured into Europe yet. But they've been champions of England five times, you know, a significant amount. You know, they've had these clusters of success. You know, early 20th century, two league titles, that this rise in the 1920s, and then, you know, straight out of the war, you know, winning the first division title and reaching, you know, Wembley for the first time, the FA Cup final in 1950, before this very dramatic, you know, fall off a cliff. So yes, you know, this is something that, you know, Liverpool fans themselves do. You know, so it's understandable that non-Liverpool supporters would know very, very little about Liverpool prior to Shankly.
First of all, Jeff, you've got to be relieved that the book was a good idea now.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's nothing like having the last 2.5 years of your life validated.
luckily, we haven't got Paul on as the other co-host, because that could have been really awkward. So, I mean, obviously, you know, Stephen, you know, brilliantly put there, you know, and talked about Shankly and how he sort of sits in the timeline of Liverpool Football Club. But for yourself, you know, the inspiration, I mean, the story is incredible. The cast of characters is incredible, as, you know, as Gary alluded to. Well, you know, there's so much depth goes into it. But what was it that triggered this book and this story, if you like?
I mean, let me say first, very quickly, that there's no greater devotee to Bill Shankly than me. But for me, I started to look at the sort of pre-Shankly era about 2.5 years ago, and I started to research some articles about the sort of the men who made Liverpool, if you like, the people who sort of created the club and sustained the club through its early years. And in that process, I discovered a guy called Tom Bromelow. And in researching the book, I found out that he lived, when he was married, he was living 2 minutes from where I live. Walk past his house most days. He was born in Kirkdale in Liverpool. He fought in World War One. He became a member of the Untouchables team. He became the first Scouse captain of Liverpool Football Club. And I became obsessed with Tom Bromelow and was actually planning to write his biography. And in the research around Bromelow, I began to realise that the picture was much, much bigger than him. Although he's an absolutely huge character, this whole team, there wasn't a star, it was an ensemble cast. If you're going to look at, you know, for a metaphor from the entertainment industry, and unbeknown to me at the time, Kieran was also looking at this period and trying to, because Kieran's also connected to the Everton Heritage Society and is doing a lot of research around the early formative years of Merseyside football. And he was very interested in the 20s as well. And we got chatting through Liverpool FC historical group and suddenly realised we were doing the same thing. We were researching the same subject. This was about 18 months, 2 years ago. And we kind of decided that these characters were too big. Their contribution was too massive to the history of the club, that to allow them to continue to, you know, wallow in obscurity, relative obscurity, would be a crime, and we couldn't let that happen. And, you know, but what we decided straight away was that this wasn't going to be a facts and figures book, although there's lots of that in there, that this was going to be a story about them. It was going to be about their lives. And then the main challenge really was, how do we do that? Because there's so many of them. And that's what led us really to pick the three main protagonists, which were the three local lads, Tom, Walter Wadsworth, and Danny Schoen. And we came up with the idea between us that what we would do is tell the story of the Untouchables through their eyes. And I hope that that's worked. You know, readers will tell me whether it did or it didn't. But we're able to view the emergence of this team through the eyes of those three local lads.
I mean, it's a great way to put it. And as you were chatting there, Jeff, to me, and I'm sure you'll agree with this as well, Gary, it's, again, we've talked about this before, it's like, it's a book about people that happens to have football as its backdrop.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yeah, me too. I mean, it is, and it's probably the best way to tell a football story that goes back so far, because you use those three guys as the eyes and the ears and the mouth of the storyteller. And it gives it a lot more depth because you're looking at it from quite a few different angles, and you know, as well as the other guys mentioned in the story from the team as well. So, yeah, it's a good way of using, as I say, different people's experiences within the story to be the story as well.
It's, obviously, you know, Stephen, massive Liverpool fan, and as we've said, and Gary got the awkward question first off, of he was, you know, writing this type of book, who would he, you know, where would he pitch it? Would it be a club that are there? For you, you know, with regards to Liverpool players, one, I suppose, you know, Jeff's book centres around these three main characters, but are there other characters in Liverpool's history that you think are, you know, because Jeff mentioned about writing a biography, a standalone biography. You know, is there anything you've ever thought of from Liverpool's playing past that you think also deserves that type of treatment and attention?
Oh, there's tons. You could pick so many, and they'd ramble into their own stories without a shadow of a doubt. Some of the players from Liverpool's first title winning sides have, you know, huge, great stories behind them. You know, the Liverpool's legendary goalkeepers, you know, before Elisha Scott, there was Sam Hardy as well. You know, there are so many, you know, worthy characters. You know, Sam Raybould as a striker, former Arsenal striker. You know, he was one of Liverpool's first superstar strikers who, you know, he later fell on hard times. You know, he would have been, you know, a very salutary kind of topic to pick of how this player can be, you know, the focal point of a league title winning side and then fall by the wayside. So sadly, you know, so many characters, not just at Liverpool, from that era. You know, you don't have to look at someone, you know, the documentary about Paddy O'Connell, for instance, you know, and you know, the saviour of Barcelona and you know, how he died in poverty. You know, these heroes, and that's what they are, because they come from an era where, you know, they're not in football for the money. You know, they're not in football to feather the nest for the rest of their life and to make it easy for themselves beyond the age of 35 to be able to retire at 35. These are players that were in it for the glory. You know, yes, they were earning more than the average person on the street. But, you know, once their careers were over, the careers were over. You know, some of the stories that are in Jeff's book, you know, talk of Danny Schoen and you know, checks that he would give to his sisters and stuff like that. You know, the generosity of these players, you know, and just being able to kind of like, you know, share in what they had. And, you know, throughout this era and stretching long into the 20th century as well, you know, players of the 50s that seemed to have the same ethos. You know, they weren't in it for the money. You know, maximum wages were in, you know, situ. Yes, there was ways around it, but, you know, these were predominantly in it for the love of the game and the glory of the game that it can bring as well. You know, there's so many characters that you could, you know, visit in this respect and within this era that would just be awe-inspiring to plot and to tell the story of and to read and listen to the story of.
You're absolutely right. You know, these cast of characters that just permeate the whole game, never mind Liverpool Football Club or even Merseyside football. Because I do want to get into Liverpool and the sort of the history and the context behind the book and when it's set and this incredible side that you've written about, Jeff. But just before we go to that, I am fascinated, obviously, having read it, and Gary mentioned about what a great historian Kieran must be, but how do you go about piecing together such what I assume must be all, I mean, there's, you know, sort of snippets there from so many local newspapers around the country, and how I can't imagine the patience that is required to piece together a book like this.
Yeah, and this is by far the biggest project I've ever undertaken. And I knew it was going, as soon as I realised that this was going to be more than Tom Bromelow's story, I realised that this was going to be a mammoth undertaking. But once I kind of decided it needed to be done, I couldn't shy away from it. I couldn't move away from it, because if I don't do it, someone else will do it. And will they do it justice? I know that sounds egotistical, but that's kind of how I felt. And so it became almost a no-brainer that I had to work with someone else, someone who give the lend the rigor in terms of research, because I kind of enjoy the research. You have to do research no matter what you're writing about. But you're right, this is on an order of magnitude far greater than anything I've attempted before. So working with Kieran was a no-brainer. I think the key to sort of tackling it was to decide on the structure very early on, and not be driven down rabbit holes every time you find out a piece of information. It was so tempting to go down all these different avenues. And, you know, I think we probably cut out about 10,000-15,000 words because we just found stuff we thought was cool and interesting and we wanted to put it in. And hopefully we've done enough of that and there isn't loads of stuff in there that isn't relevant. But it was agreeing a structure and an approach to it and staying laser focused to that, really. So we wanted to tell their backstories. We knew that the war was going to be pivotal because that shapes them as human beings, whether they went or didn't go. And then it was about the emergence of this team. How did this team come together? You know, what was different? Because largely a lot of the players who made up the Untouchables were there before under Patterson. So what was different under Ashworth? There's a whole debate around the role of manager there and, you know, whether the manager had anything to do with the team or whether he was just kind of a recruitment guy and a secretary. And there's certainly evidence that some of the coaching staff felt that they were the ones who were really building the team and managing the team on the pitch. And then we wanted to explore what happened to them afterwards. So we kept that kind of real rigid structure in mind the whole time and focused the research on that. Nevertheless, there were lots of occasions when, you know, you find something and it poses another question and you have to go off digging and looking elsewhere. So when we were doing, for example, when we were looking at Tom's war service and Danny's war service and all the other guys, you know, we had to, I mean, there's a case where, you know, Danny suffers, you know, potentially life-threatening wounds in France towards the end of the war. And so we had to kind of research, where was he exactly? Pinpoint him on the battlefield. How far away from the hospital was he that he was ultimately transported to? How long would that have taken? What would they have done in the field? What would that have felt like for him? What would that have been like for him? And then what was it like when he ultimately ended up in the hospital? And what would, you know, what type of treatment could he have expected to give? Because we wanted to get a sense of how near to death he was, how dangerous a situation this was for him. Because it's interesting and it tells us something about his life, but also it kind of makes what happened later even more remarkable. You know, that when he comes home, not only does he kind of manage to keep things together and play football, but he plays football at the highest level, albeit he's not one of the big stars of that team. He plays football at the highest level. And I just think that that's incredibly remarkable. It's you're part writer, part storyteller, part detective, really. And it's, you know, it's the source material. It's where do you start? Well, you do start with Google to an extent. You start with talking to family members, and you get leads, and then you go off looking in the archives and the newspaper clippings. I must say we received a tremendous amount of help from other writers and historians and the club and Liverpool Football Club. Stephen Doan, their museum curator, was very helpful. Johnny Stockland, their archivist, gave up lots of his time. Mark Platt from LFC TV. Nothing was too much trouble in terms of helping us out and supporting us. And I think what we will do is we will have enhanced their knowledge of that team as well, so they'll update their record books as a result of the research we've done. So that's a kind of quid pro quo, really, and it's worked out quite nicely that way, particularly in terms of the war service. You know, their files will be enhanced and improved as a result of the work that we've done. So I'm very proud of that.
Rightly so as well, rightly so. Just as you were chatting then just towards the end, I'm really sorry, just another quick question. How did the club receive the project that you were undertaking?
Fantastically. The club are aware. I think the club's done some absolutely tremendous work, I must say, in celebrating the sort of highlighting the lesser celebrated figures in the club's history. The 100 players who shook the COP project, the 50 men who made Liverpool. These are all really great projects. And the club was aware of the anniversary of the first title. And so, before we even got a chance to approach them, we received approaches from them to say, particularly Mark and Stephen and Johnny, we've heard that you're working on this project. We think it's a fantastic project. If there is anything we can do to help, don't hesitate to ask. And that's just been like that across the board. There's lots of Liverpool, I'm sure lots of other clubs do as well, but Liverpool have a kind of core sort of cadre of people who are absolutely fascinated with the history of the club, and all of them approached us and said, if you need anything, if there's anything I have. We're program collectors. So Andy Marsden, who's got an unbelievable program collector, introduced us to several other collectors, and we managed to get so much information from those programs in terms of the editor's notes in them were incredible, because you read the editor's notes in today's match day programs and they're very sanitized, aren't they? You read these program notes and they don't pull any punches at all. And we got a real insight into the era, not just from the writing, but from the adverts in the programs as well. So you got to know what kind of products were on sale, what the entertainment in the city was like, so what was on in the theatre, and what acts were around, and just really opened up a window for us, and we were able to really peer through and see vividly what it was like to live in Liverpool at that time.
It's absolutely fascinating, absolutely fascinating. Gary, it's quite an important period. Jeff's mentioned it there. Obviously, there's the history of Liverpool Football Club and Everton, and the sort of split from Everton that then goes on to form Liverpool Football Club. But this time I've stopped myself because I've heard my question in my head and I'm not asking it the way it's going to sound. Because it's going to sound like you were there, but that's not what I meant.
Okay.
But in terms of football, sort of post-World War One, it was a really important time for the game in terms of, there'd been this hiatus in the game. Players or men were coming back completely different to the men who left 4 years previously. It was a really, to me, and certainly, and I've not seen anything like the depth that Jeff has, but, to me, it was always such an important part for football to establish itself again, having become relatively new in terms of professionalism prior to the start of the war.
Yeah, absolutely. When the First World War was on, they had a women's football, which was used almost as like a surrogate, a substitute for the men being away. Obviously now the women's football now is far more than that, and rightly so. But when they came back, when the guys came back, I think you can't overstate the peril that these guys went through. And I'm really chuffed that Jeff mentioned about the Danny Schoen when he was wounded. It really paints a picture of the close to death some of these guys came, and it's to go through that sort of situation and to come back and then sort of devote your time and energies to being a football player must seem, I wouldn't say mundane, but having faced a life and death situation, anything after that is smaller. But they so many players fought in the First World War and came back and played football, and it was a massive thing for the people, the fans, and Jeff picks up on this in the book, and how the tendencies, it was a release for people as well as the soldiers coming back, for the people who were sort of gone through wartime privations.
Stephen, I know you're currently practicing muting your face, your mouth, yourself, your image. I get that. But in terms of, Jeff's sort of been chatting about been chatting about sort of the importance of the war, you know, and where that sits in terms of the development of the professional game, you know, and Jeff's been talking about where you get this sort of information from. But in terms of football in Merseyside sort of post World War II, I mean, I suppose, and this is going to sound, and Jeff can completely correct me here, but I guess it's almost like a resetting of standards. You know, to me, everybody is back at the same level again, sort of post World War I.
Yeah, I think it's got to be a multifaceted thing. You know, you've got players, you know, as Gary says, you know, coming back from war and, you know, trying to countenance, you know, what they've just seen, what they've just been involved with, and then offsetting it as being kind of like, well, I'm a football player again, and what's the significance of it when push comes to shove? But on the opposite side of that, you know, the fact that you could just, I don't know, slot back into what they must have seen as normality had to have been utterly precious, you know, to be able to go back to what was before, you know, and to walk away from the horrors that you've just been part of, to say, look, I can kick a ball around again. You know, it must have felt like paradise to be able to walk back onto a football pitch and just play football. And, you know, within that, there must have been, yes, a degree of I don't know, kind of like a kind of, I don't know, some kind of, I don't know, karma found in some manner, you know, some kind of peace of mind. But within that, yes, you know, players are so much older than they were when they stopped kicking a ball around. You know, football clubs have had to acclimatise. Financial difficulties will have, you know, arisen at certain clubs. Some clubs will have prospered more than others. You know, with both major wars, there were certain clubs that bounced out of war on a stronger footing than others had. You know, some have been strong as war descended and then came back much weaker. So, you know, yes, the landscape has changed somewhat, but for the players themselves, especially the ones that went to war, you know, it must have been quite surreal. It must have been, but at the same time, an utter joy. And yes, on one side, you turn around and saying, well, look, you know, this new reality, you know, and what it should mean in comparison to what they've just bore witness to. But at the same time, it must have been something that felt like an impossible dream at one point to be able to take part in again. And I'm sure it must have been, a massively, a completely different era, you know, a buttoned up era where emotions aren't on display somewhat. And you only have to look at the match reports that are on offer for great evidence of that. I'm sure internally, you know, some of these players must have been on the brink of, you know, spontaneous combustion almost to be able to go out there and play football again.
It is, and I suppose, again, you know, as you mentioned there, you know, all those people, you know, that we can't even begin to comprehend what it was like and what they went through in those years. But, you know, for you, Jeff, you mentioned right at the beginning, you know, you decided to sort of base the book around the story of these people, you know, and the sort of three main characters that you pick, and you introduce them so early in the book, and, you know, you make no bones about it that this is the story of a side, mainly through the lives of these three players. And again, I know you talked about Tom Bromelow, and it's starting off potentially being a biography about him, but was there ever, once you decided to, like you said, to fully open up and commit to the story of the side, was it always those three? You know, was there ever potential for four? Could it have just been two? Or, you know, did those three for you just absolutely hit the sweet spot in terms of what you wanted to do with this book?
Yeah, absolutely. Initially, it was Tom and Walter. And, you know, amazingly, it feels now, I didn't really know much about Danny at all. And as soon as we started to find out about Danny and chat to Danny's family have done incredible research. You know, I have to pay tribute to them, Douglas Barlow and John English. They've done tremendous research themselves into Danny. To them, Danny is an absolute hero. As a young boy, John English, Danny's nephew, he was a Tottenham supporter. until his mother told him your Uncle Danny wouldn't be very happy about that. He used to play for Liverpool, and from that moment on, he was hooked. And he's done enormous amounts of research himself into Danny's record. And once we had Danny, once we kind of had a fleshed out image of Danny, I realised we had Tom, who was a superstar, and did go on to become a superstar, who served in the war and was a veteran. We had Walter, who didn't go to war, who was less of a superstar, but a really fascinating character because he's such a no-nonsense, brusque, interesting guy. Bears uncanny resemblance. I know you shouldn't compare because it's different eras, but I can't help but compare Walter to Jamie Carragher. But born in Bootle, both, Walter famously was abused all through a game in Sheffield and decided he wasn't having any of it and climbed into the stand and thumped the wrong guy as it happened. and then we had Danny, who was the lesser light, if you like, no disrespect to him, but didn't play as many games. So we had the reserve struggling to break through. We had the superstar and we had the workman and the craftsman in Walter. And all three were from Liverpool and born within a very short distance of each other around the same time. Fascinates me that, they were born around the time that Everton split into two. So they will have grown up with the emergence of this new club in the city. Once we had Danny, then it was always going to be those three. And we would view the rest of the team through that lens. The friendships they made.
So can you say something before we go on?
Yeah, absolutely, Gary. Yeah,
because when I read the book, I made a note of a quote in the book, and I've just found it. I put it in my file here for when we're the podcast, and I've just picked it up. And this is where I spoke earlier, but you asked me about the players and the First World War, and there's a passage, and I mean it's unerringly true. And it's a couple of sentences. Forgive me, Jeff, for quoting you here. Forgive me.
No problem.
A sea of mud under a clag of gas and rain, men carrying trenches carved in the earth by shovels carried on backs that ache for home. The stench of the fallen who have been swallowed by the land, drowned or cut down by shrapnel and bullets sprayed by an unseen foe, mixed with the sickening reek of chlorine and filled their nostrils, curdling their bellies. There is no bird song to greet the rising sun. Just a chorus of ordnance falling in the air like monstrous peals of thunder. Bombs land shaking the ground and obliterating their targets. People went through that. And, people listening will say, well, why do you think this Jeff's great author? Things like that. Passages like that.
Thank you. I mean, the thing I want, whatever I write, I want the reader to be immersed, completely immersed in the story, and to almost feel and see, what's happening. That's really important to me because if you're telling someone's story, even if it's fiction, if you're telling someone's story, you want the reader to be invested. You want them to care about this individual. And as I read through, lots about World War One. I read lots about Passchendaele because Tom was in Passchendaele. I talked to Jacqueline Wadsworth, who's Walter's granddaughter, who's a World War One historian. She's written a couple of books about letters home from the trenches. And as I was reading these letters and reading these reference books about the war, and it was starting to really build up in me. I could almost see in my mind's eye these scenes, and then trying to place these guys who played football in the middle of all that. Imagine what that must have felt like. And so I was incredibly moved. And I mean, it was quite moving to listen to you read that, to be honest, because it was, I really wanted to paint a picture of exactly what they went through, and that's an attempt to do that. And I think they went through sheer, I mean, we talk about how it must have felt coming back. I mean, we have to think, we can't view it through the same lens we view trauma now. Society's attitudes towards mental health were completely different back then. And working class people's expectations were not what they are now. So men and women expected a tough life, and going off to fight for king and country was expected. And some men lived in fear of being called cowards. And men who quite understandably broke down on the battlefield were often referred to by their comrades, even not just the officers, but by their comrades as cowards. So it would have been incredibly difficult for them coming home to actually manifest any outward signs. And all of the families we talk to of the men who served say, without exception, say that they remember no stories of their relatives talking about the trauma or talking about how hard it was. They don't talk about that. They might talk about their experiences, but they don't refer to the mental trauma that they experienced. And I think that's quite telling. It tells us about the era.
Sorry about that, Steve.
No. It's absolutely perfect. I was going to say to Stephen, the last sort of five or six minutes there, Stephen, is, you know, something we go on about how, not just football, it can be any sport, it can be any art, it can be any form of entertainment, whatever you want, but how you can really help young people understand history, social history, social context through a lens that is enjoyable in terms of it. People want to learn about it and engage in it. It doesn't just have to be the dry textbook. You can reach young people now through any medium that they enjoy and teach them about social history and get them to really understand what it was like. Any young child or who loves football, has a love for football, and certainly anyone who loves Liverpool Football Club, will read Jeff's book and also have an intense understanding, not only of World War One, but also what it was like afterwards, the social impact on the country, the psychological impact of the men. And yet it's done through it's done through a lens where that youngsters will want to learn.
Yes, to be able to do that and put it within a recognisable concept or a landscape that is familiar to them. The great thing about Liverpool Football Club, the great thing about a lot of football teams and things that tends to be lost by clubs that move away from traditional homes is that the football stadium at Liverpool Anfield is still within the same streets as it was 100 years ago. So, you know, you can walk down to the ground past all the terraced houses that there are, all the streets, many of which are mentioned in this book, you know, and you can imagine them being, you know, doing exactly the same. The things that are different, you know, are as striking as the things that are the same, you know, because there's still so much that is the same about watching football now to what it's always been, you know, the way that people will arrive at a game, the routes that they will take to the stadium. You know, perhaps the bakery that they pop into over the road, maybe the pub that they go into if they're a bit older, you know, and it's those similarities. And you can take, you know, someone back 100, 120, 130 years, 140 years, whatever, simply by, you know, taking them there via something that they know. You know, it's placing that thing that is familiar to them. And, you know, just giving it a whole new coating of, you know, history and saying, well, look, these streets have been here for that long. And you know, they were here before that ground popped up, you know, and these are the people that have been beforehand. You know, yes, it's, you know, nowadays it's Mo Salah, it's Virgil van Dijk. You know, many years ago, it was Don McKinley. You know, it was Dick Forshaw. You know, it was Bromelow, it was Schoen, it was all of those. And in between, there's been, you know, many other heroes, you know, that have filled those casting roles, basically. And that's what they are, the casting roles, be that the owners of the club, the chairman, you know, the manager, the players. you know, the supporters as the backdrop. You know, football, you know, as much as it changes, a hell of a lot stays the same. And it can be used as a wonderful, you know, learning tool, basically, you know, to be able to open, you know, to broaden minds, to open eyes.
What a great quote! might have that on the tile when this goes online.
You can have that one, Stu.
Yeah, I love that. I'll send a note to Lewis at 44:49. What Stephen said. Just mentioning that, Jeff, and as Stephen was saying there about things staying the same and yet being so different, but obviously said it far more eloquently than that. The manager at the time, David Ashworth, you know, we look at managers now and their propensity for coming and going, and no offence to Gary's club, but you can win the league and the cup, you can win the European Cup, and you can still be on your way. And, you know, managers come and go, you know, and again, we look at this story that you've written and, you know, the players and the backdrop that you've talked about, but David Ashworth is also a really key component in this whole story, and yet it could have been last season at a football club, for example, the sort of scenario that happens.
Yeah, I mean, for me, Ashworth's one of the most intriguing characters of the whole story, really. And I mean, he wins the first title, and then halfway through winning the second title with Liverpool at the top of the league, around the December period, he spectacularly and to the shock of everyone, resigns to take up a post at his former club, Oldham, who were fighting relegation. Fails to save them from relegation, and Liverpool go on to win their second title. And the reasons for him doing that have been, you know, the source of much speculation for a long time, and many theories have been put forward. We think we've categorically debunked many of those theories, really. And obviously, what I would say about David Ashworth is the more you read about him, the more you scratch the surface, the more interesting and bizarre his story becomes. He is a very eccentric character, very mercurial, a nomad, footballing nomad, a nomad as a child. And his story is absolutely fascinating. But there's no doubt about it. When he left, it was a seismic shock for Liverpool. There's much speculation about the role of man, much talk about the role of manager at the time, and you know, we'd probably look at the role of secretary manager, and we'd probably compare it to a director of football today. And there's certainly parallels there, but it's not quite as clear cut as that. Certainly, George Patterson, who preceded Ashworth, he was more of a director of football. He was more of an administrator. Certainly didn't have the capacity that Ashworth did and Tom Watson before him to inspire and to organise the team and to be involved in formation and tactics and training. He was more like that. But Ashworth and Watson before him, they were more than a director of football, really. They did get involved in the day-to-day management of the team, as well as going on scouting missions. I mean, interestingly, you know, one of the things that's really struck us is quite often during a game, the manager wouldn't even be in the stadium. He'd be off on a scouting mission somewhere looking for players, or he'd be off on business, in inverted commas, and the running, the management, if you like, of the team during the game was left to the captain. But interestingly, there are stories of Ashworth being on the training pitch. There are stories of Ashworth's antics during matches and him being clearly engaged in the game and clearly exhorting his players. So he was a character that did have an impact on the club. It's obvious he had an impact on the team. And we can see that by the team's performance, largely the same team before he joined, and the team after McQueen left, you know, and Patterson took up the reins again. We can see that, you know, he had an impact on the club. He had pulled it together. He had organised it, and he had made a big difference. Who knows if he'd have stayed, whether Liverpool would have gone on to win another title under him. I think it's a moot point because I don't think he was capable of staying at a club for that long. I think he was always destined to go somewhere else. You know, he'd get itchy feet and decide to move. So, yeah, his story's, you know, at times comedic, but always fascinating.
I mean, like we say, Gary, you know, sometimes, you know, stories can, you know, and certainly football today, the managers, most managers, you know, there is the odd exception, you know, where the manager become, you know, is just as big as the players. But again, this is, you know, another part of this fascinating story that Jeff brought to us, where the manager is also so important, but because of the time and the era, you know, as Jeff's, you know, put it, essentially, in black and white, you've got to look at where they were before he arrived and where they were when he left. And that's how you judge it, because you have nothing else.
Yeah, absolutely. When I read this part of the story, you know, there's been a little bit of a sort of teasing through with that. And, you know, Jeff mentions in the story about Ashworth's nomadic ways. But when you come to the part where he left, you know, with Liverpool sort of destined to win a second successive title, you think, what? What? And it was really, I mean, have I missed a part of the story? You end up flicking back a couple of pages to think, you know, have I missed something here? But there isn't, and it's an intriguing part of the book, and, you know, the story of this team. And, you know, as you say, there's two ways of looking at this. You know, did he make a difference or did he not make a difference? Well, they didn't win the titles before he came, and they didn't win it for the 25 years after he left. So he must have done something, you know, and the coaches who sort of said, well, I want this guy, it was me. Well, what are you doing afterwards, Tiger, when he'd gone? You know, so you and it's interesting as well about Jeff saying about the scouting issue, because obviously all games, you know, in those days were played at the same time. So you can't go and scout while your team's not playing, because they all play at the same time. There's none of these games have moved to Monday evening because of Sky or Friday afternoon at 3 o'clock or wherever it is. Discovery Channel, whatever they do these days. But I just think Ashworth is an incredible story about how and why, and to leave a team that that were champions and, you know, destined to retain that title, and go back to a former club who were on the verge of relegation and get relegated, basically sort of never reached, I mean, Ashworth never reached those heights again, he did with Liverpool. It's a fascinating aspect of the book, absolutely fascinating.
And again, just sorry, Stu, just to jump in on that. The other thing that blows my mind, to be honest, is he's never out of work. You know, he's coveted by clubs all over the north of England. And he's constantly being offered jobs and taking jobs all over the place. Hugely popular figure in the game. So many articles refer to him as Davey. There's so many kind of affectionate stories by journalists about his quirky ways and his sometimes, shall we say, he doesn't exactly always play by the rules when it comes to signing players. And, you know, but it's all mentioned with a smile. Clearly, hugely popular figure in the game, and someone who'd played football as well, who'd actually played at an amateur level. So he'd refereed the game, he played the game, and he'd been a manager secretary at a number of clubs before he arrived at Liverpool. So he knew the administration side, he knew how to put a team together, he knew what the game, the ebb and flow of a game, and he knew the rules of the game. So, you know, one of the great characters of the period, without a doubt.
It's, I mean, when I was reading it and again listening to you there as well, Jeff, and, you know, your quote, Stephen, that I'm still trying to work out in my head how you said it, but about, you know, about the game. And to me, the first person I thought of was Ron Saunders winning the league and then walking away from a European Cup campaign and sort of the quad, you know, and just like, you know, like Gary said, why would you do that? You know, how often are Villa going to get a chance at the European Cup? Or, you know, he was doing well with him. He probably thought it'd last forever, but why would you do that? And it was nearly 60 years later, and the self same thing is still happening in the game.
It takes a strong mind to do something like that, not a weak mind. You know, this is a, you know, a decision being made and a point of principle and some description. whether, you know, and the so Jeff and Kieran go into a lot of the potential avenues to why this happens. But, you know, I don't think we're ever going to know. And, you know, I've known of David Ashworth for, I don't know, the best part of it. I remember being bought a book for around about my 16th birthday, and it was like a history of Liverpool book, a big, thick tome it was as well. And all the kind of like the players of the past and every Liverpool manager up to Kenny Dalglish was in it. And I remember sifting through them and thinking, well, I'd heard of Tom Watson on that great BBC History of Liverpool video and all this type of stuff. And then when it came to David Ashworth, and you're looking thinking, he's left partway through a title-winning season as reigning champions. And it automatically makes him incredulous and somewhat eccentric. You know, there's some eccentricity at play here. There must be someone out there that's done this type of thing before, and obviously Ron Saunders is as close as we can think of here. But to lead a team that are league champions into a season where they will retain the league title, walk away at Christmas, and then end the season being relegated with someone else is potentially unique, you know, and it just adds more and more. You know, mystery and luster to what is a fascinating character that is ultimately out of reach because of the era from which he's from.
I mean, like I say, you know, this is a, you know, it's a fascinating chat, and it comes from what is essentially a wonderful, wonderful book. We're already at the hour mark, but I just want to sort of ask Jeff as well. Well, there's a couple of things. One is, first of all, compliments in that these stories are so important, and, you know, Gary and Steve and I and whoever else comes on, we chat about this subject quite a lot, about the importance of telling these stories before it gets lost and before they become impossible to tell, or they get lost in the mists of time, or, you know, things change. So first of all, you know, people should be grateful for people like yourself who take the sheer amount of time and patience to tell what are really, really important stories while they can still be told. And the second question is, would you do it again? would you pick anything further back, or would you go into, like you said, it's the biggest project you've undertaken, but has it given you an appetite for it?
Yes, it has. My only problem is that my wife's assured me that if I start writing again soon, she'll change the locks. So my output's been pretty, I've gone through a bit of a purple patch, and my output's been pretty prolific over the last few years, but that takes its toll. A bit of a necessary break is in order, I think, but absolutely, I mean, there are other stories to be told. We do touch on the earlier years before, we touch on sort of the two league titles, the dawn of the 20th century. There's another incredible team. There's, you know, the story of the split has been dealt with in numerous ways, but I think there's an opportunity to really delve into that and really delve into the people involved, because I read a lot of things around the characters involved in the split, and what I began to realise is there's lots of conflicting stories about, you know, the protagonists and who was guilty, and as with all sort of endeavours in history, you often find that the truth is a lot more grey, and people you thought were villains are not really villains, or they are a little bit, but not as much as you thought. So, you know, I think there's lots of stories in Liverpool's history. But again, the other thing is, when I look at Merseyside football, and I kind of touched into the amateur leagues where some of these players emerged, there's some fascinating stories there, you know, teams that whose light shone really brightly for a very brief period of time, and then they blinked out of existence, you know. And so there's lots of places we could go, really, in terms of the pre-war history of football in this region. And I wouldn't rule out going back there again sometime soon, just not yet.
Yeah, because I feel like you've just had your Steve Redgrave moment. I feel like you can never go near a keyboard again.
Well, yeah, that might be the case.
Yeah, don't let your wife listen to the last 5 minutes of this podcast, whatever.
She's doing. Actually standing a few feet away from me.
Yeah, that was a nervous look.
She's got the rolling pin in hand, Jeff.
Sorry, Volcani.
I said, she's got the rolling pin ready to blank you on with.
Oh, dear.
I mean, I will, in all seriousness, I will write again, absolutely. And I'm too fascinated about the history of football in this region and this club. And as I say, there's just so many stories that we could uncover and delve into. It'd be too tempting not to.
Absolutely. I think it's good. Well, obviously, we just want to have you on for a couple of years. But that's
I'd like to say it's nice knowing you anyway. Yeah. And it's been fun.
Yeah. My posthumous favourite author is how
Jeff is our favourite. Very much our favourite ex-author.
Yeah. do you remember that last book he did that was really good?
Yeah. About the thing is, the books will probably sell much better after I'm gone.
Exactly. That's exactly it, isn't it? That's the way to up the price. Gary, just sort of your final thoughts, but it's, we say it so many times, it's so important that people, we're not sure that we've got it in us to take responsibility. So it's really important that people like Jeff and Jeff's wife take responsibility to allow for these books to be written.
Of course it is. I'm working on a project at the moment which is related to the Ajax teams in the 70s. It's 50 years from Ajax in next year when the book comes out. And I was sort of mindful that, that there's only three players surviving from the first European Cup triumph in 71. And that was difficult enough. That was difficult enough to get people, to be able to reference there. But to go back, the distance that Jeff and Kieran's gone back, and to post, I'd never heard of the Untouchables, I have to say. I mean, not being a Liverpool fan, I mean, that's probably entirely understandable. But yeah, I've now got a kinship with a team I've never heard of before. I know about players there. I know about the managers, there, and I know circumstances around the players that I had no idea of. And it's something that if people don't tell these stories, they're never going to be known other than in a small couple of people. I mean, Liverpool fans will know about this, but outside Liverpool fans, probably very, very few football fans know about it. And it's just a fascinating story. So, they need to be told because I don't know how much farther back you can go. Jeff's talking about this sort of the early years of the 1900s now, for his potential next project, Mrs. Golding allowing. It's important to know these things because if you don't know where you come from, you don't know where you're going.
Absolutely full of the quotes tonight. I need to come up with something really quickly, but I'll see what I can do. Stephen, I mean, obviously passionate Liverpool fan, as is Jeff, but to me, these are always the books that transcend football tribalism, if you like. These are the books that football fans should be reading. It doesn't matter what the club is, when you're reading stories like this, when you're reading books like this, really it can be about any club and you can enjoy it. Also, whether it's because I don't support a team, maybe I'm looking at it slightly differently. But to me, it's...
No.
You don't have to be a Liverpool fan to get something from it.
You don't. I'll always hark back to a book I read, probably stretching almost 20 years ago now, I suppose, written by Gary Imlach, who people might remember as being kind of like doing Channel 4 American football and always on the Tour de France and all sorts of kind of like sports like that. Sometimes tip up on Serie A with Channel 4. And his dad, Stuart Imlach, was a footballer and he played for Nottingham Forest in the 59 FA Cup final, Scottish international, went to the 58 World Cup. He coached at Everton before being kind of like shown the door after a change of management and all that type of stuff. And it was a wonderful book that had absolutely nothing to do with the team I support, but it was the human element of it all. And it was that sense of struggle, and it's stripping away, that gloss that we all think that football has, or at least at some part of our life we all think football has, and just coming up with the sometimes grim reality of the situation as well, you know, and there's wonderful part of that book. There's a great part where Stuart kind of like walks the walk that his dad did after Forest go back after winning the cup and the parading it around the centre of Nottingham and stuff like that, and it's passages of and words and chapters that put you within that era, you know, and there's a certain skill to doing that, and Jeff and Kieran have absolutely nailed it for this, because it's the type of book that you read and you're not reading it from a detached point of view, and you should be, because it's something that happened 100 years ago, but it makes you feel like you're along for the ride, and you are watching those games that are taking place. You're walking the streets with them, and it doesn't matter who you support. It is exactly that type of book that will just spirit you away. As you know, Gary's pointed out there, Chelsea fan, and he is drawn in by the story of this team, and you know it is exactly what we say it is there.
It is, and it's a perfect way to finish. You know, Jeff, you know, the book, The Untouchables, Anfield's Band of Brothers. It's a work of art. It's one of those books that clearly as a Liverpool fan needed writing, but. You know, to me, just as a football fan, books like that need writing. They absolutely do need writing. And I have nothing but admiration for those who are prepared to do what it takes. And like you said, it's about doing those books justice as well, because, you know, clearly there's no shortcut to them, or there's certainly no shortcut to a book that has value, which yours has in absolute spades. You can't do these books quickly. You either commit or don't even start, that there's no point. But it is, congratulations. It is such a wonderful book and a wonderful story.
Oh, well, listen, thank you very much. I'm absolutely overwhelmed by your comments, and it does make it worthwhile. We've had some lovely feedback so far, and you guys will know as well as me that you throw your heart and soul into these projects because they matter to you, they mean something to you, and to get feedback like that, it just makes it all worthwhile. Amongst some of the really nice feedback we've had is from the families themselves who've told us they feel like we've done their loved ones justice, and we've preserved their legacy. A big thing in my life is this idea of legacy, which is what you leave behind. And just the thought that that can be lost and forgotten almost terrifies me. And so, for us to be able to do that for them, is huge. And then to the wider football community, people who are interested in the sport, for them to get something from it, that's just huge in my book. So a big thank you to the three of you for what you've said.
Never any need to thank us ever. Like I say, it's just a shame that this is going to be your last podcast appearance. That's all. If I'd known it was going to be your last one, I'd have done something special at the beginning.
The next one might be from a cardboard box somewhere.
A posthumous one. We'll do it like the ABBA thing. We'll have holograms of you and stuff like that.
It'll just be me in the clothes I'm standing in.
That's it. Yeah. Gary, enjoyed it.
Terrific, mate. I mean, we could talk with Jeff about football, on so many things, but the book is, Jeff and Steve just mentioned that you haven't got to be a Liverpool fan to enjoy the book. I'm not a Liverpool fan, and I enjoyed the book massively because, as I say, it gave me a kinship with a football team, a team, not a club, but a team I'd never even heard of before. I knew nothing about. And if you're a true football fan, I think that's almost inevitable when you read a book of this quality, and it is a very high quality. And the research that Kieran must have put into it, and the quality of Jeff writing just makes it a dream book. Very so readable.
Stephen, obviously, there's no need to ask you if you've enjoyed it, because you already validated that it was a good idea to write the book. So clearly you've had a great time.
I've had a wonderful time. You know, I've said before, because, you know, Jeff's part of the TFT furniture as well. You know, he's written the magazine, he's done, online articles for us. You know, he's clocking up the podcast appearances brilliantly. And, you know, every time we put, I've often said it, you know, it feels like the book stagged him. You know, it's, you know, and this is another one of them. And it is, it's a brilliant book. Go out and buy it.
It is. And I've just had an idea. I'm going to change it from the Centre Circle podcast to the Jeff Goulding podcast in memory of.
The memorial.
That's it. That's the greatest honor I can bestow upon you, is to name the football book podcast after you. Jeff, thank you ever so much. It's been absolutely brilliant. All that's left for me to say is thank you for listening, and please join us again next time on the Lob podcast with These Football Times, where I don't know if Jeff will be here or not. But thank you for listening, and bye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.